your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. 11:01 here on the wake-up call. Let's give a shout-out to Rusty Simpre. He always brags about how he can time the show just right, finishing up at 11 o'clock. That's right. A little self-satisfaction there for Rusty. Let's thank the folks, Harrisonburg's 95.1, for joining us as well. And the folks at Dixon Disposal supporting WNRN. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. And with Dixon, there isn't any sorting or separating. You can put trash in one can, and they do the rest. Dixon also offers single-stream recycling. For more information, it's DixonDisposal.com or 434-978-2111. All right, our conversation today specifically about a project here in Charlottesville, but it carries over to, I believe, all of our listening areas as we talk about poverty and ways to help solve some of the problems. Our guest today, Ridge, Skylar Ridge, is it income deficiency? Is that the phrase that I'm looking for?
Yes, it is.
All right, so we're going to be talking about poverty and a solution to income deficiency. It is the Orange Dot Project. And so let's jump right in. Our guest today, Ridge Skylar, the project director of the Orange Dot Project. Three sentences on what the Orange Dot Project is, Ridge.
I will give you the three sentences, but at first I'd like to thank you for inviting me here this morning, and I think it's appropriate that we're following up here in Charlottesville, home of UVA, following up Bluegrass Sunday morning with the Orange Dot Project. The Orange Dot Project is really focused on a problem that we may have a sense is occurring in Charlottesville, but we don't really focus on it, which is the number of people living in poverty in our midst in Charlottesville. And what we found is that the bulk of these folks are really single moms trying to raise their families, and they just don't make enough income to make ends meet without some kind of outside help. And so what we're trying to do is figure out the scope of that problem and then figure out a solution that allows families to be income self-sufficient.
Now, so that's the mission of the project. What brought about the report being done at all?
Well, first of all, I used to work at the Nature Conservancy, and I left that job to become the district director for Congressman Tom Perriello. And when I left the Nature Conservancy, we had a wonderful map maker there, and he made me a map of the 5th Congressional District, which, as your listeners may know, stretches from Greene County all the way down to the North Carolina line. It's an area larger than the state of New Jersey, and he color-coded a map based on median household income for census tracts or neighborhoods all over that 5th Congressional District. And he color-coded very low median income as dark orange and very high median income as dark green. And you could just look at the map and see kind of where the areas of struggle were and where the areas of affluence were. And when you looked around Charlottesville, what you saw was a large area of green around Charlottesville, and in the middle of the city, a big orange dot where all the poor people lived. And so that really, from the moment I saw that map, it really crystallized what we kind of know just driving around town, which is that there are people in our midst who are truly struggling. And the question is, what can we do to try to end those struggles and help folks lift themselves to self-sufficiency? So
now,
that's what really spurred it.
I'm sure that there were more than one person who heard you say that you worked for Tom Perriello, and now we're talking about ways to solve poverty, who just went, oh, good Lord. You know, what a bunch of liberalist material they're talking about today.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there isn't a liberal or conservative concern for fellow human beings. I think there's an innate sense that we need to help those among us who are struggling. And the question is your approach one that is practical, reasonable, affordable, and that will actually work to solve the problem? And I think that most of us, certainly most Americans, have a sense that we like to identify and solve problems. We've done it throughout our history, and the question is, here is a very real problem. that surrounds us. We have moms trying to raise their kids without the income to be self-sufficient. And I think all people from all persuasions are compelled to think of, are there answers, are there ways to end that cycle of poverty that are reasonable and affordable and effective? And that's what this Orange Dot Project tries to tackle. It doesn't come at it from any political avenue. It comes at it from the kind of human imperative to help our fellow man.
All right, so we're going to be talking about the Orange Dot Project. The guest today, the project director, Ridge Schuyler. And we're not just talking about the fact that the map was done about where poverty is seen in the Charlottesville area, but one of the things that I think makes this a little different from previous conversations that have been had on the Wake Up Call is the back half of the project is devoted to solution ideas. And so we will be getting into that a little bit down the road, not too far. But for those folks who didn't hear a program that we've done, I believe we did it in April of last year with Rebecca Trippett on a project that was done at the UVA's Walden Cooper Center, where we talked about this a little bit. Let's do a little more background. One of the things that I found interesting as we talk about the problem of poverty is that you mentioned 20% of families in our area suffer from, if not poverty, with the inability to be self-sufficient as a family. And it's, I think the word that I picked from your report is surprising. You list it as a surprising number of 20%. Why did you use that description?
Well, I say surprising because when people think of Charlottesville, I don't think, I don't think they think of a city that is facing a poverty problem. You look around the city, especially if you travel its most well-traveled highways and roadways, you don't see a lot of poverty, maybe from your car. And when you look at Charlottesville from the numbers, from the outside, you look at median family income in Charlottesville, it's $60,000 a year. So the median family in Charlottesville makes $60,000 a year. People say that they're doing pretty well. And when you say we have a poverty problem in Charlottesville, many Charlottesville boosters will immediately respond, well, that's just the students. Students, when they report their incomes on the census forms, their salaries are meager. It's what they make during the summer. And so it's easily discounted when you look at a median family income of $60,000 and a UVA students who look to be driving up the poverty rate, a lot of people can then discount the issue. And what I wanted to do is look very hard at the numbers and make sure that we knew the scope of our problem. And as it turns out, when you look at families, 20% of the families don't even make enough to survive, which is to provide food, shelter, clothing, and utilities without some outside help.
Well, let's talk about that. Survival expense.
Right.
And again, we are talking about the Orange Dot Project. And one of the things that I found most interesting is you go above the poverty line. I think for anyone who is willing to be realistic in the discussion, I think that figure goes back to 1960s and has been adjusted as we go forward. But if you have any realism in your thought process, you understand that it hasn't changed in ways that society has changed.
Right.
So when you talk about survival expenses, explain, please.
Right. So what I looked at was, what does it cost to survive in our community? And it's just paying for the essentials: food, shelter, clothing, and utilities. Without those four essential items, you cannot survive. If you don't have a roof over your head, if you don't have food in your stomach, you cannot survive. And so I refer to those as survival expenses, and I looked in Charlottesville, what are they? How much does it cost to rent a two-bedroom apartment for a family, a mom and her two kids? What does it cost to feed that family for a year? What does it cost to clothe that family for a year? And so I looked at those survival expenses, which seems a much more realistic way of assessing poverty than the way we did it back in 1963, which is the federal poverty line, which was in 1963, the cost of food was a third of your disposable income. And so to determine federal poverty, they just took the cost of food and multiplied it by three. Well, because of the efficiency of our agricultural production, the cost of food is a much lower percentage of your disposable income, but the cost of housing has gone up, the proportional cost of clothing has gone up. So looking at those four essentials seem to make a lot more sense than just multiplying what it costs to feed a family by three.
And when you talk about survival expenses, you're talking about the Charlottesville area.
Right.
Are you talking about just the city or the Charlottesville-Albemarle area? But you're not using a federal
right.
national number.
Right. So the food is a federal national number because food, for the most part, although we've got this burgeoning local food movement that's not just here but all over the country, but really, you know, food is a kind of there's a national cost of food that is pretty translatable across the country except for, you know, certain very high dollar places. But shelter in particular is a very local cost. And our shelter cost, the cost of housing in Charlottesville, is very high because of the demand of people to move here and also the demands placed on our rental market by students. So I looked at very specifically the cost of housing in Charlottesville. What does it take to rent, for example, a two-bedroom apartment in the city of Charlottesville? And also transportation. I looked at what does it cost to buy a bus fare in the city of Charlottesville.
Right, you're not talking about a car. To run a car.
Nope.
People would say, oh, well, you need to cut the money you're spending. And I think it's fair to say that looking at the expense of buying a bus ticket is looking at a way for a family to cut their expenses.
Right. And of course, transportation and childcare are those costs that a family incurs in order to make the money they need in order to survive. So you kind of have two different categories of expenses. One is the cost of survival, food, shelter, clothing, utilities. And then there are the added costs that you incur in order to go make the money in order to survive. And those are transportation and childcare. When you add those two things together, the costs to survive and the costs to make the money to survive, you wind up with a number very similar to the one that the Weldon Cooper Center came up with, which is for a mom and her two kids to make the money to be self-sufficient in Charlottesville, she needs to earn $35,000 a year.
You have repeatedly talked about a single female parent. Why?
Because when you look at the data, it is pretty clear that it is single moms with dependent children who are the ones who are truly struggling. That isn't to say that other people aren't struggling. It is not to discount that. But if I were single and you know, fortunately, I found a woman who had the poor judgment to decide to marry me. But if you're a single person and you're making minimum wage and you can find somebody to be your roommate, you can probably eke out survival on minimum wage in Charlottesville. It's not pretty, but you can probably do it. If you're a mom trying to feed two children on that same minimum wage job, it can't be done without some kind of external help.
Well, somebody out there is going, don't get pregnant. Get married and, you know, stay married. That's the problem, and you brought that upon yourself.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, my approach to this is to meet people where they are, because the alternative is to do nothing for them. And you know, one of the challenges that we have is a cycle of poverty, where it is pretty clear that a child born into poverty is likely to stay in poverty for their lives. So children in poverty become parents in poverty, and that cycle continues. If you're going to break that cycle, you have to figure out a way to help that parent find meaningful work so that she can pull herself out of poverty, so that her kids are not consigned to poverty the way the data would suggest that they would be if a job weren't available.
11:14 on the Wake Up Call. Thanks for tuning in to WNRN. We are talking about the Orange Dot Project with the project director, Ridge Schuyler. I see the phone ringing right now. You're welcome to dial in, 979-0919. Toll free 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. You started off talking about the problem of poverty and how Mr. Schuyler came up with some of the figures that he did. We will be getting into what I found to be interesting suggestions for the solution of the problem. Ridge, you talk about it being a single parent problem, and I mentioned it at the start of the program, the local income deficit. Explain that phrase.
So in order to scope the problem, what I wanted to do is first figure out, you know, how many families do we have that are struggling? How many families are not self-sufficient, do not make a sufficient wage to provide for themselves without some kind of outside help? And in looking at the census data that was there and looking at this cost of survival and the amount of money you need to earn in order to make the money to survive, I then calculated that there are approximately 2,069 families in Charlottesville who do not make a sufficient wage to be self-sufficient. And so now we have the number of families, and that's 2,069 families out of the 7,033 families that live in Charlottesville. That's about 30% of our families do not make a self-sufficient income. And then I wanted to see, well, how much would it take to lift all of those families, all 2,069 families, to this level of self-sufficiency? What is this local income deficit? How much is this gap that we have to fill with income, with work? And the number that I came up with was between $20 and $30 million a year in income that these families would need to earn in order to raise themselves from a position of dependency to a position of self-sufficiency where they can provide for themselves and provide for their children.
All right, I definitely want to get back to that, but let's take our call from Scott here in Charlottesville. Hey, Scott, you with me?
I am. My voice is a little thin today, and I was just running an errand and happened to cut on the radio, so I apologize for not hearing the whole show. And if I heard correctly, I think the recent information kind of feeds into my question, which I'm never sure whether to think of poverty, particularly in a sort of somewhat artificial construct of national boundaries, so we'll say poverty in the United States. Is it correct or incorrect to think of it in terms of not being a sort of zero-sum game? In other words, are the resources in place for anybody who wants to be out of poverty if they given the resources and so forth to be out of it, or at some point do we bump up against there are only so many resources to go around, so there's always going to be a stratification where some people are going to be below what we consider a poverty level?
Thanks, man. Ridge?
Well, that's an excellent question, and there are lots of components to that question that was posed. But I think, you know, one approach that I would say is, you know, is this a lack of resources being devoted to the problem? And, you know, I look at Charlottesville, and it is interesting. We are a very blessed community. We are blessed both with the wealth that surrounds us and also with the goodwill that is in the hearts of many. And I think it's interesting in the same Seville Weekly edition that had an article about the Orange Dot Project, on the very next page, there was a little blurb that said that Charlottesville follows Beverly Hills on Forbes millionaires list. And it also says that it is also Charlottesville's on Forbes generous towns list, which means both we have a lot of affluent people and we also have a lot of affluent people who are very philanthropic. We have a plethora, a huge number of nonprofits and agencies designed to help in all kinds of areas, including helping people in the low wealth communities. I think the problem in Charlottesville is not so much a lack of resources, perhaps, but a lack of coordination and a lack of access of those resources for the people who are struggling. Sometimes, if you're a parent trying to provide for your children and you're struggling every day to get them to school, to go to job interviews, to try to find work, but you don't have the training that you need, sometimes the resources that are around you are simply inaccessible to you. To me, I liken it to, you know, it's like having all of the resources of the Alderman Library, but without the card catalog. If you have no way to access those resources, then they may as well not exist. And I think one of the issues that we need to confront in Charlottesville is providing easier access to the resources and the help that is available to folks who are struggling. So I don't see it so much as a lack of resources as a lack of coordination and a lack of access and a lack of clear focus on what it takes to get folks out of poverty. And as I mentioned earlier, part of this is people can fall into a cycle of poverty where, as I mentioned, the data suggests that children in poverty become parents in poverty. To break that cycle requires extraordinary intensive effort, and that's what I'm talking about. How do we do that in a city that is as blessed as Charlottesville is? And that's what the Orange Dot Project is really focused on doing.
And we are talking about the Orange Dot Project with Ridge Schuyler, who's the project director. The problem of poverty, and in just a moment we'll be getting to the solution that was offered in the Orange Dot Project. Phone lines open, and I see it ringing, 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN rocks. Let me give you the markets of Tiger Few forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs in the mid-50, and then mostly cloudy with a 20% chance of rain or snow after midnight tonight, lows in the low 30s. And then mostly cloudy tomorrow with a 40% chance of showers, highs 45 to 50. Right now, it's a pretty nice day outside, 40 in the valley, 50 in Lynchburg, 53 in Richmond, and 50 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's thank the folks at Blue Ridge Graphics for their support. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 434-296-9746, online, brgtshirts.com. I can see somebody's holding online. We'll get to them in just a second. Ridge, I believe that Scott sort of brought up the topic about, won't folks always, you know, where do we bump up against the bar? And isn't our culture of capitalist society, isn't there always going to be somebody at the bottom who's in a poverty setting?
I think that it is very likely that there are people who may find themselves in poverty and not have the willpower to get out. And I, on the other end of the spectrum, I think there are people who are born to poverty. There are people who are born to poverty who figure out ways to get up. Who get up and get out. I'm looking at that group in the middle who want to get out, who want to find a pathway out of poverty, but can't seem to find that pathway. And that's what I'm focused on doing.
All right. Let's see. We got a car from Phil on his car phone. Phil, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Fire away.
Rich, I was wondering, I'm a student, recently graduated, but looking to go to grad school. I guess my question is, with your poverty cycle, I guess the effects of education, they always talk of to better your lifestyle, and I think nowadays I don't agree with the situation or the statement that education will help you in a better quality of life. So I was just wondering if your statistics of 20% of families or people living in Charlottesville are in poverty, are any of those students or is that only families?
The number, 20% do not earn enough to just the survival wage. And 30%, nearly 30% don't earn enough to work and earn that survival rate. So I would say the number is really closer to 30%, and it does not include it includes just families. It does include, you know, grad student families in Charlottesville, but primarily it does not include single undergraduates. It really focuses on families, related people living in the same household. But I would like to follow up on your issue about education. But if you have a follow up while you're driving your car, we're happy to listen to that too.
Phil, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, your follow up to that, to Ridge explaining his percentages.
Well, I guess the thing is that through everyone always says, go get education, you can get a better job. And me and my fiance just graduated, and it's very hard out here to find a job that is better than a menial job still at this point. So I guess I was just wondering to see if you had any statistics of how us students who just graduated moving back with families is the only support we have to stay out of poverty.
Thanks, Phil. Keep listening.
All right. Well, let me first of all, congratulations to you and your fiance for graduating. Let me say that. I mean, first of all, our nation has suffered the greatest economic shock since the Great Depression, and so I think folks who just graduated from college are entering in one of the toughest economic markets that we've had since the 1930s, and so the question is not, I think, just so much, does that education benefit me now? Because right now everybody is struggling. But as we come out of this dip, will your education serve you well in the future? And I think there's no question that it will. And one of the statistics that I think is interesting, and I hate talking about statistics. Former Vice Mayor Holly Edwards, you know, constantly reminds us that behind all of these numbers, behind all these statistics, are actual people living actual lives. This is moms with kids who lived right down the street from us, and these are real people. They're not just numbers. But I will throw out some information that I thought was interesting. I mentioned earlier that in the city of Charlottesville, the median family income is $60,000 a year. So people look at that and they say that's a pretty comfortable community. But when you look down into our neighborhoods, you see a very, very different story. And there are two neighborhoods in the city of Charlottesville that they literally adjoin. Oddly, across a railroad track. In one of the neighborhoods, the median family income is $102,000 a year. In the immediately adjacent neighborhood, the median family income is $21,000 a year. $21,000 a year. Now, when you look at those two neighborhoods, you look at the neighborhood where families are making $21,000 a year. If you look at educational attainment in that neighborhood, you see that almost 50% of the adults in that neighborhood did not graduate from high school. And nearly half of them didn't get to high school. So what we have is we have people who, for whatever reason, and I don't think there's any benefit in looking backwards and placing blame. I think we need to look forward and figure out a solution. There are folks who did not graduate from high school, and the result of that, I think there is a pretty good correlation, is that the amount they are able to earn has been very, very much diminished. And the question is, what are we going to do for those folks? What we have are folks who did not graduate from high school. There's no way we can go back and rewind the clock and have them graduate from high school. But they are parents of kids, and we know that if those parents struggle, their kids will struggle. So what do we do for those parents? How do we get them on a pathway out of poverty, which in America, because of our capitalist system, which somebody mentioned, one of the callers mentioned, really the only way out of poverty is work, is a job, is a decent job. And so really the question boils down to how do we find meaningful work for people who want to find a way out of poverty in Charlottesville?
We are talking with Ridge Schuyler, the project director of the Orange Dot Project. Please understand that while the Orange Dot Project represents a map for the city of Charlottesville, obviously the topic covers everyone, Harrisonburg, Lexington, Lynchburg, Richmond, and Levingston. Dial us up if you have a question or a comment. That's 979-0919. The toll-free number is 877-967-6762. But let me take a moment and thank the folks who are supporting WNRN and the wake-up call, such as The Backyard, UVA Corner's culinary secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The Backyard has a seasonal menu. They have daily specials and a rotating list of beers on tap. Backyard is now open on Sundays, serving brunch, and then a pub food menu until close. For more information, 202-8215, thebackyarduva.com, and their Facebook page. I see someone dialed us up. Dial us back, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. Ridge, I want to get into the solutions that were a big part of this project. You talk about the two-generation problem. Explain that a little bit more.
Right. Well, I mean, it really ties back into what we've said a couple of times during the show, which is that the data suggests, and a long history of data suggests, that children of poverty become parents in poverty. And so what you have is you have, in a lot of respects, generational poverty. And the question is, how do you break that cycle? Well, we are doing a very good job, it seems to me, in our public school system. My kids go to city schools, and there is a lot of attention paid to trying to close the achievement gap in our city schools and try to make sure that kids, no matter what neighborhoods they come from, no matter what zip code they are from, are getting a quality education so they can move up and out if they choose to do so. And the city they're embarking on an effort called the City of Promise. The city just got, I believe, a $500,000 grant that's aimed at trying to further close this achievement gap and help kids achieve their full potential. My theory, and I say this as a parent, is that you can't just focus on the kids, although it's obviously necessary and important to focus on the children, but you also have to focus on their parents. That if a child comes home from school every day and their parents feel like the system has left them behind, that they have no way out, that has implications for those kids. And so the two-generation strategy is to say we need to work not just with the kids, important though that is, but we also need to work with their parents to help their parents identify and seize opportunities as a way out of poverty. And if we don't do both, I think the hill we have to climb is much steeper.
In the project, you talk about an issue that happened at the University of Pennsylvania. Talk about that.
Right. So the question is, when you look across the nation, last 40 years of anti-poverty efforts, you know, there have been many things that have tried, a lot of things that haven't worked. And what we need to do is learn from each of those experiences and try to find the ideas that work and improve upon them and apply them in the places where we live. And there was a very interesting circumstance in West Philadelphia in the late 1990s and early 2000 that I think might provide us an opportunity here in Charlottesville. West Philadelphia is the home to the University of Pennsylvania, and in the late 1990s, there was a great crime epidemic in West Philadelphia. A lot of folks struggling around the University of Pennsylvania, and sadly, on a Halloween night in 1996, a professor was walking from his lab to his off-campus house, and he was robbed and stabbed to death. And that horrible crime catalyzed the community, and parents from all over the country descended upon the University of Pennsylvania and demanded to know from the president of the University of Pennsylvania what they were going to do about the fact that their kids were going to school in an area that was surrounded by a lot of difficulty. And Penn realized that they needed to do something to fix the neighborhood around them, because they only had three options. And they really contemplated all of these. They thought, well, we could move, we could build walls up around our university, or we could try to fix the neighborhood that surrounds us, the community that surrounds us. And they decided to do the third. And they did a number of things, and they have been doing them since the early 2000s, charter schools and buying up dilapidated apartments and rehabbing them for student housing. But one of the things they realized is that they had to do a better job of job creation in their community. And they thought to themselves, well, what can we do? And the University of Pennsylvania realized that, and they didn't realize, but they understood that they purchased every year $600 million worth of goods and services in order to keep the university running. And they thought to themselves, well, what if we figured out a way to direct some of that $600 million worth of purchasing into the neighborhoods that surround us? And they set about doing that. And the way they did it was, they said to their procurement people, part of your job promotion, part of your advancement at the university depends on how much local purchasing you do. And every month the president would get a report of how much purchasing was done from West Philadelphia, and every quarter the Board of Trustees was given a report about how much was purchased from West Philadelphia. As a result of that intensive, decided effort to buy more goods and services from the surrounding community, the University of Pennsylvania has made a dent in the poverty problem that surrounds them. And to give an example of how successful their effort was, in 1985, when they first started keeping track of how much local goods and services they bought, in 1985 they bought $1 million worth of goods and services from West Philadelphia. Last year, they bought $110 million worth of goods and services from West Philadelphia. The question is, can we use the same approach, which is harnessing the powerhouses, the economic powerhouses in our regional community, and figure out a way to make it easy and affordable for them to buy some greater percentage of their goods and services from local vendors who hire these folks in poverty who live in our midst? And that really is at the heart of a solution that I've offered in this report, is a practical way of harnessing these economic powerhouses and directing some of that economic activity into our local communities.
All right. Now, the Orange Dot Project, our discussion today with Ridge Schuyler, who was the project director, this was presented to the Greater Charlottesville Area Development Corporation. What is that? Who is that?
So it is the foundation arm of the local Chamber of Commerce. The Charlottesville Area Chamber of Commerce has a nonprofit arm, which is the Greater Charlottesville Area Development Corporation, And this idea of combating poverty through job creation was something of that they were very interested in pursuing. And so they talked to me about scoping the problem and offering up some solutions, which is where the Orange Dot report came from. I think one of the reasons why I don't think this is a partisan matter, to go back to a question that you asked at the very beginning of the show, is that job creation and job growth and promoting small local businesses isn't a partisan issue. It is about strengthening our community. It's about finding places of meaningful work for potential employees. It's about expanding business opportunities for entrepreneurs and existing employers. There's nothing partisan about that. It's about strengthening our entire community by lifting up people who are struggling and expanding economic opportunities for businesses that already exist.
11:36 on the Wake Up Call, talking about poverty and solutions to poverty through the Orange Dot Project. Ridge, you say that it's not a partisan issue, and it's not, until you get into how to solve the problem and what creates the problem. And then I believe that it becomes completely partisan. You look at it on a national level, it's, we all want jobs, but you're doing it wrong, we need to do it my way. Well, that doesn't work, because then you leave this out. And I'm going to get into this, I don't want to jump ahead of myself on questions or comments about some of the, you know, parts of the solution that were offered. But we talk about creating jobs in the areas in which they're needed. You mentioned elsewhere in the project that the single parent needing child care, and we're talking about a single mother for the most part who needs child care for 2 to 3 kids, correct?
Right.
And what I wrote down as my note was, a single parent needing child care needs to be paid $17.50 to $20 an hour.
Right. If paying market rates for child care in the city of Charlottesville, that's exactly right.
How many people just laughed at that?
Well, and let me. So there are two things to say about the solution. First, let me address the partisan thing. It sounds like you're going to get to that later. But what I look at is I like to look at data. I like to look at what works. I like to look at where have successful efforts been done elsewhere, and then build on them. And what we know is that most job creation is done by the expansion of an existing small business. That's 80% of jobs that are created are expansion of an existing small business. And so our focus on job creation, I think, needs to be, all right, well, how do you go about, as a practical matter, how do you go about allowing a small business to expand so they are in a position to hire more workers? Well, what a small business needs in order to expand is access to more markets, more places to sell their goods and services. The idea of the Orange Dot Project is, how can we open up the very markets that surround us to those small businesses? How can we provide entree to the large economic engines for the small business that maybe makes window treatments or that bakes bread? How do we provide them, get them better access to the purchasers who live right down the road from them? So that is at the heart of this. It's building off of what we know works, which is the expansion of a small business. Now, the amount of money that it takes to survive is a function of how much it costs to survive. And so you can look at the income side of the equation, which is the one you just referenced, and I agree. The idea that we're going to create $35,000 a year jobs for people who did not graduate from high school right off the bat is not realistic. But you can work on the other side of the equation too. What if, instead of trying to create jobs that pay $35,000 a year, you decrease the expenses so they don't have to make $35,000 a year? What if we had a smarter way of providing affordable housing in the city of Charlottesville so that that mom doesn't have to pay $931 a month for a two-bedroom apartment? She can pay $800 a month or $400 a month. Could we be smarter about reducing the expense side? Regarding childcare, the city of Charlottesville is promoting an idea of pre-kindergarten education, which would provide universally accessible education to kids 3 to 6, right before they get to kindergarten. If we were successful in doing that, then when that child gets to be 3 years old, you don't have to pay for childcare anymore. You send them to school. There's a double benefit for that. Not only are you reducing the expenses for that mom, but research also shows that pre-kindergarten education helps boost the academic performance of that child over time. So that effort in the city of Charlottesville, which was designed primarily to close the achievement gap, has the added benefit of lowering our income deficit because it relieves from that mom the burden of paying market rates for child care for one of the kids that she would need to put in child care in order to go to work to earn the money she needs to feed and house and clothe them. And so I think it's that kind of coordinated effort that we really need to deploy here in Charlottesville in an intensive, deliberate way in order to figure out if there's a way of creating a pathway out of poverty for folks.
11:40 here on Sunday morning's Wake Up Call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, before illness, addiction, and injury claimed her life, Linda Doig was an elite international model whose face graced magazine covers. She ended up homeless, living in Lee Park, or is her companion to blame for her death? Virginia National Bank has experienced a leadership shakeup with nearly one-third of the Board of Trustees having quit. Do we know why? And once convicted of attempted murder, can you have the news stories deleted from your past? An ex-convict wants The Hook to delete his stories from its website. And The Hook, free no matter what the weather. And a big thanks to Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, where your happiness is their priority. At Blue Ridge, you can return gear and apparel purchases at any time for any reason. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road here in Charlottesville, three locations in Richmond. For more store information, it's brms.com. 11:42. Phone lines are open. Questions, comments about the Orange Dot Project, problems and solutions for poverty. Ridge Schuyler, the project director here in the studio today. Ridge, we were talking about the, I mentioned the $17.50, you know, hourly wage to solve the income problem. And so you mentioned, look, it's not just looking at creating the, a rise in financial income, it's also looking at a way to delete the expenses. One of the things that I found interesting in the Orange Dot Project, the goods and services. So, but we have a problem with that. Are we solving the problem by forcing the city, the university? Because one of the problems that I heard immediately after it happened because of a friend of mine working in this industry, is the city of Charlottesville, when they were rebricking the downtown mall, gave that business to some company in Maryland with a handful of businesses in our immediate area who had applied for the task. What do you do to solve that? How do you make them do offer the goods out there to local folks?
Right. So, first of all, I don't think the answer lies in forcing people to do anything. What I'm really trying to construct is a way to make it easy and affordable for the economic engines that surround us to buy from folks who are local business people who hire local folks as a way of lifting them up out of poverty. One of the problems that the city has, particularly as a purchaser of goods and services, is that they are subject to state procurement laws, and state procurement laws require that you buy from the lowest bidder, no matter what other benefits may obtain from buying from somebody who might not have the absolute lowest bid, but might have other qualifications going for them. I think that one of the things that we ought to do is change our procurement laws that would allow a city spending local taxpayer dollars, allow, not require, but allow them to spend those locally generated tax dollars on locally generated businesses, because that money then reverberates within the community. That city that buys maybe a slightly higher priced bricklayer who is from this area is going to see that money come back to them through the purchases of that bricklayer, through the taxes that bricklayer who lives in the city pays. And so I think there ought to be a little bit more latitude provided to our cities to allow them to buy from local vendors when that is an option. It doesn't require them, and if they want to buy from the lowest bidder, even if they're from Maryland, they'd be perfectly able to do that. But if they see benefits in hiring from local vendors, then they ought to be able to do that. And that requires a change in our state laws. And that's something that I think is part of what an idea that we should be pursuing.
When you presented this report, how was it accepted?
I got a very positive reception, and I released it with some amount of trepidation because, you know, there are a lot of people in this community who've been working on fighting poverty a lot longer than I have, and who are true experts in this and who have given their hearts and their lives to combating this problem. And to be honest, I was a little bit worried that people would see this as an effort to go in and assign blame or point fingers and complain about a problem that we've not yet solved. And I took great pains in my report to say, you know, this is a problem. This is a national problem that we've lived with for 40 years, and nobody has figured out quite how to do it. I have the luxury of being able to take some time to scope the situation and to offer up a few ideas that maybe we haven't considered yet that we could deploy in Charlottesville. And people have received it in the spirit with which it was offered, which is, here's another idea that might provide a practical, implementable approach to poverty eradication, or at least poverty reduction in the city of Charlottesville, and has been taken in that spirit.
We are talking about poverty, not just the problem, but some of the potential solutions and a project, the Orange Dot Project, presented by Ridge Schuyler. 11:46 on the Wake Up Call. Your question or comment is welcome on the program, 979-0919. A little further away, you need the toll-free number. It's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Ridge, a phrase that I read throughout the project, the job hub.
Right. So we've identified the problem. We've got, you know, 2,069 families that do not make a wage that is sufficient to sustain themselves. We know that we have an income deficit that's $20 to $30 million. We know that 80% of most new jobs are created by the expansion of existing business, and that job creation is really the only realistic pathway out of poverty for people in America. With all of that, we think, all right, well, so how do we take all that information and use it to solve the problem? Well, the latest literature says that one of the most effective ways of combating poverty in a community is to harness the economic activity that is surrounding you. So the question is, how, as a practical matter, do you do that? We have incredible economic powerhouses around us, and we're very fortunate to have them. We have the University of Virginia, we have State Farm and Martha Jefferson Hospital, we have the Defense Intelligence Agency and the North Grounds Intelligence Center, we've got Northrop Grumman, we've got all kinds of economic engines around us who buy goods and services every single day. How do we make it easy and affordable for them to buy from local vendors who hire local folks? And the idea of the hub is a way of bridging that gap. When you look at, let's just pick the University of Virginia as an example, because, you know, their information is public, so it's a lot easier to figure out kind of what's going on there than it is with some of these private enterprises. But you look at the University of Virginia, and they have to comply with state laws, et cetera.
And people forget that they're a nonprofit organization.
Right.
And not the hospital part, but the academic side is a nonprofit.
Right, and they've got budgets to meet, and they've got goods and services they have to provide in order to do their mission of education of students. The question is, you know, with an institution as big as the University of Virginia, with the demands that it has, it may be very difficult for a very small business to figure out how to negotiate the intricacies of e-procurement at the University of Virginia. What this hub would do is say, instead of having all of these small businesses in Charlottesville try to learn how to do e-procurement at the University of Virginia or figure out a way to sell services to State Farm, what if there was a one-stop shop for those buyers where they could contact this one-stop shop and say, do you have anybody in the community who does window treatments or who provides catering services or who bakes bread? Because that's a need that we have. So this hub would look at requests for proposals, look at what goods and services are needed by these anchor institutions, and then go out in the community and find the small vendors who can provide those goods and services to provide a bridge between the large institutional buyers and the small business sellers. Because those sellers, I mean, it's interesting, in our community, we have interested sellers. We have small businesses that provide the kinds of goods and services that these larger institutions are buying. But for whatever reason, they are having a hard time getting access to those markets. Similarly, we have large institutions that would be happy to buy locally if they could identify those local providers.
Well, you say that they would be happy to do so, but my understanding from conversations about the topic from friends who actually do work, do this process with what you call some of the economic powerhouses trying to be a seller to these groups, is that the feedback that they get is that it's not in the seller's best interest.
Right. So the seller, it's not in the seller's best interest, not the buyer's.
Excuse me. It's not in, well, to go back to the specific, it's not in the University of Virginia's best interest to buy from the smaller seller.
So the question is, how do we make it easy and affordable for the university to buy from that local seller? And I agree, if we have a local baker who's charging $3 for a loaf of bread and the University of Virginia can buy it from Aramark for 49 cents, it's going to be hard to persuade the University of Virginia to buy from that local baker, and that's understandable. The question is, can we get within a range of price that makes it easy and affordable for the university to buy from that local vendor? And I don't believe that we have begun to explore those opportunities as fully as we should. And, you know, and this has got to be done from a business perspective. It's got to make sense from a dollars and cents perspective. But I, in talking to I'm sure some of the same people you're talking to, the university position is we would be happy to buy it from local vendors so long as those local vendors providing the quality and the price that we demand. Well, there's an experience. I talked to the chief financial officer of Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, and there was a circumstance that Case Western had very similar to the University of Pennsylvania, where they were building a massive new building in the middle of the campus. That campus is in the middle of Cleveland, surrounded by four wards of very impoverished folks. When they hired the contractors to build that building, virtually all the contractors were from outside the area. People from the area went and complained, and it's just that the Rolodex at the procurement office didn't have the names and numbers of those local vendors. They then made a concerted effort to try to identify and hire those local vendors, and what they found was same quality, lower cost. Counterintuitive, but it has to do with travel expenses and all kinds of other factors about some benefits of buying locally. They found, much to their surprise, that they could get the same quality goods at a lower price buying locally. Now, that's not every bit. I mean, we're not going to make microscopes for the University of Virginia in the city of Charlottesville, but there are things that they buy that we might be able to make if we work in partnership to identify them and then figure out who's a small business who could provide those and hire people from the low-wealth community to do the work that is necessary to provide those goods and services.
11:53 in the wake-up call. Finishing up our conversation with Rich Schuyler about the Orange Dot Project, not just problem of poverty, but a solution as well. A few minutes left if you'd like to call in with your question or comment, 979-0919. I see my man Drew Thompson has walked into the studio. That's because in just a few moments at noon, Les Temps Purdue will begin. Drew features the best in 80s and 90s alternative, bands like Public Image Limited, New Order, and Roxy Music, as well as he takes your request. Les Temps Purdue brought to you in part by Caliente. And the support today also coming from L. Oppelman's Central Virginia's Complete Music Headquarters, continuously operated since 1890 at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's music department now featuring acoustic guitars, banjos, mandolins, and violins, as well as electric guitar packages and complete drum sets. L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in Lynchburg, and at loppelman.com. All right, Ridge, the local job hub, so it's created. Is the goal to create more jobs or more income, you know, payment, higher wages?
Right. The initial effort is to create more jobs, to start people on the pathway out of poverty by providing them meaningful work. And again, the idea of the hub is to provide access for small businesses to markets that already exist around us. And as those businesses expand, they hire people from these neighborhoods and get them on the path to working and ultimately on a path out of poverty. So that's in a nutshell what that hub is designed to do.
So this is not my own commentary, So a $7.60, whatever the minimum wage is, an $8 an hour job is better than no job.
Right.
All right. But I think we all know that the highest expense for a business owner is labor cost. So will these people hired at the minimum wage ever make anything more to reach and reduce this income deficiency that we've talked about earlier?
Right. So, again, focusing on the income deficiency, I think we need to look both at the income and the expenses side. But let's talk about the income side for a second. What we are imagining with this Orange Dot project is that the small businesses that are growing, that are hiring folks, are businesses in the community. They are people that those employers who may be, this may be new, employment may be new to them. Those employers are people they're going to see at church, run into in the grocery store, meet on the sidewalk. That is materially different than going to work for a big corporation where your shift may get changed and all of a sudden the daycare that you struggled so hard to set up for your kids is completely wiped out because instead of working from 7 to 3, you're working from 9 until 5. So, you know, I think that there is a material difference between working for a business that is located in your community than working at minimum wage for some larger operation. And so that's part of it, is that the nature of the work, even if the pay isn't greater, the nature of the work is different. The other part of this is there are training programs, there are ways of providing skills to folks. But right now, you know, in talking to people who live in the low wealth community and people who are struggling, there is a lack of hope out there, and part of I worry again about when I released this report, I worried a little bit about being yet another of the hope danglers, the people who dangle and then snatch away the hope, and that has been done so often that I think there are a lot of people who've just kind of thrown up their hands and said there's no way out, and there's really nothing more disheartening than talking to a mom who feels like she's got no way to provide for her own family, no possible means of escape from a situation in which she finds herself. If we can provide that pathway and she starts to believe again that there is a way out, then those job training programs, those skill development programs, then have a lot more meaning to her then than they do to her now. And so that's part of this. It's a long, difficult climb, but if we don't start focusing on it with an intentional, long-term effort, then I don't think there's any way that we can succeed. We're not guaranteed to succeed in the path that we've laid out here, but we're guaranteed to fail if we don't pursue a path.
All right, 11:57 on the wake-up call. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Just a moment left with our guest today, Ridge Schuyler, talking about the Orange Dot Project. Ridge, it sounds fascinating. You have provided interest and hope for me. I don't know that I fall into the orange dot, but I am unemployed. So you know, there is this. How does the job hub get started?
Right.
Who starts it? And I understand the premise, but who's responsible for making it work?
Right. So right now, the stage of the Orange Dot Project scoped the problem, developed a solution. It's not the only solution. There are lots of smart people who live in Charlottesville, and there may be another series of great ideas for how to move people from poverty into meaningful employment. This is just one of them. But the next stage of the Orange Dot Project is to get this hub up and running, that means getting lawyers involved. And so we've gotten lawyers involved, And it's great. They're donating their time to figure out how to set this hub up so that it works for the University of Virginia, the Martha Jefferson Hospital, the State Farms of the world, and it also works for these small businesses. I mean, we got to make the hub so that it's self-financing, but it doesn't take too much money out of each contract, because that money that flows from a contract from one of these large economic powerhouses needs to flow as much as possible through to the business that is hiring the people. So That hub is in the process of getting formed as a legal entity, and once it's up and running, then there is a one-stop shop that we can actually deploy to start making this happen.
Is there a place that people can go? Is there a website? Is there anything like that where people can either keep track of it or contribute commentary?
Right. So part of this is about putting up a website, but there isn't one up up now.
All right. Well, we'll keep track of that and alert people when it is. Don't forget, you can go back and listen to the entire hour about our discussion if you got tuned in late. SeavillePodcast.com will have that up shortly. And not by any intent, next Sunday we'll be talking with Kelly Sokol, who runs the Albemarle County GED program, and we'll be talking about that and having a couple folks come in who made some decisions earlier in their life that they regretted enough that made it necessary for them to come back and choose the GED program. Ridge, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Drew Thompson up next. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call.